And these questions will be obviously directed to a particular person, but the entire panel is encouraged to weigh in where appropriate. Dr. Grant, have you ever used an intraoperative scan with a probe for parathyroid surgery?
No, I've never used an intraoperative, like a sestamibi scan. I know there, for first-time operations, there are people who use the probe regularly. I think that's fallen further and further out of favor, because to really distinguish single versus multiple gland disease with a probe, I think Jim Norman was one of the big proponents of that, and I think he's even gone away from that now. Occasionally, you can use intraoperative ultrasound, but I really find that in the neck, in contrast to using it, as I'll show you in the insulinoma, in the neck, I think it's very difficult to get a good scan using ultrasound. So I very seldom use intraoperative ultrasound, and I have not been a big proponent of using the probe for parathyroid surgery. That there are others, though, that would speak strongly in favor of that.
Dr. Crose, how about ultrasound for screening for carotid injury?
It doesn't work. That's the short answer. The longer answer is because typically these lesions, even though they may start very close to the bifurcation or in the proximal internal, they extend all the way up frequently to the skull base. And so for the same reason, you'd say, well, gee, if it's a isolated dissection, why not just resect that and either put a vein graft or something in there? It doesn't work because the artery itself is damaged. The typical mechanism is not a direct blow, but it's more of a stretching, a sort of a violent stretching in the neck, and the internal gets stretched over the transverse processes of usually C2 and C3, and so then that progression and that dissection extends all the way up into the skull base. So you've got an artery that sort of looks like dog meat, and you can't operate on it. So that doesn't really work. Others have tried ultrasound. There have been several things published about it. It just doesn't work. The sensitivity and the specificity are horrible. So,
Dr. Grant, there was a couple of questions regarding follow-up of incidentaloma. So you've diagnosed a small incidentaloma, and you mentioned one CT scan. But could you kind of clarify how you follow those folks long-term?
Yeah. I don't think there are any really good data to base that on. So this is pretty much our practice, but largely conjecture. When we see a CT scan, if it really is quite definitively benign, that is Hounsfield units less than 10, that is always benign, and follow-up on that I think is largely unnecessary. But if you're following something that is much more typical of what we do, and that is they've got kind of intermediate, but for whatever reason you choose not to operate, it may be small even though it looks a little funny by phenotype, we have typically recommended that they get follow-up scans anywhere from 3 to 6 months. Now, the reason for such a rapid CT scan at 3 months is that if you're really worried, the only thing you're trying to prevent is overlooking an adrenal cancer. And our rationale is that if it's an adrenal cancer, it's going to grow even in 3 months. So 3 or 6 months, we've done that, and I've actually seen, as I said, the 2.4 centimeter cancer grow in 3 months, and we ended up operating, and by the time we took it out, it was about 4 centimeters. So it had grown, we took it out, it was definitively a cancer, and I think it's one of those rare situations where you're happy with the follow-up. To be honest, I don't think that 100% of our patients get that kind of follow-up, but that's our usual recommendation, is somewhere 3 to 6 months of follow-up CT.
Great. Dr. McGrath, regarding your SMV portal vein resection, how do you reconstruct that? And as a sort of a follow-up question, if you're comfortable telling us, what happened to your 34-year-old that you did that resection on?
That's where it's beneficial to have a young partner that came in and did the, he does the vein resection. Anastomosis for me. but it there's a lot of different techniques. Rarely would it ever, sometimes it'll include found an IJ interposition graph to probably be one of the better ones. The other technique that's been utilized is actually ligating the splenic vein and swinging that down to the SMV to be able to do that. And rarely do you have the capability of sort of just a primary resection. When possible, if possible, if you can get a side biter on there and just take a portion of the vein too, that's amenable to primary repair. That patient is relatively out and is doing fine.
Great.
They do run into trouble sometimes with SMV thrombosis, but and some people think that eventually they'll all end up with some degree of that, but they usually collateralize prior to that.
Okay, great. Thank you. Dr. Grant, in a patient that has hypercortisolism and some asymmetry of the size of the adrenal glands, do you ever still go to renal vein sampling?
Boy, that is really uncommon. Have we done it? Yes, but it is really rare. What we usually see is if somebody has an adrenal source for hypercortisolism, it's either an adenoma, a carcinoma. They can have what's called micronodular, primary pigmented nodular adrenal disease, which is part of a syndrome at times, or macronodular, both of those being bilateral. But usually it's a definitive nodule or a definitive cancer that causes hypercortisolism, and it's usually not a difficult thing to figure out which side to take out. What has been looked at, if you're really talking about sort of pink zebras, is macronodular disease that affects both sides and trying to somehow save one side so that the patient doesn't have to depend on exogenous cortisol replacement. That has been tried. We've not been happy with that because almost always there's excess cortisol secretion from both sides. So that's when you've got the really large macronodular hyperplasia. We still recommend bilateral adrenalectomy and replacement.
Yeah, and this is another good one for you, Dr. Grant. What about a 6-centimeter, very low Hounsfield adenoma? The radiologist says it looks like a lipoma.
Yeah, and I was going to address that and just kind of overlooked it. That's one of the few times when you can be very confident of it being benign, and that is if a radiologist confidently says it's a myelolipoma. They have a very characteristic look. It's pure fat with myeloid elements in it. It sort of swirls around, and it has a very characteristic look, and you can be confident that that's benign. On rare occasion, they actually can bleed. And so it's not a 0% chance you'd need an operation, but it's low.
All right, Dr. Kuros, I think you answered this, but it's a shift for the way most of us practice. Your practice and your recommendation is that if someone's getting a head CT, they're getting a CTA of the neck for blunt trauma.
Yes. The reason that we do it that way is because that's really the only way to adequately screen. If you believe that blunt cerebrovascular injuries occur, which I firmly believe that they do, then the way to identify those patients before they have a stroke is to be very aggressive in screening. Now, if you think back and I'm sure that you've probably seen the 20-year-old guy who comes in with an isolated femur fracture, and he gets his femur nailed, and he's up on the floor, and he's doing pretty well, and then all of a sudden he dies, right? And we think, oh, well, the guy must have had a pulmonary embolus, because that's what everybody has when they die. They always die of a pulmonary embolus. It couldn't possibly be anything else. So, you know, then the guy, you know, you don't think anything about it. And if you're in a place that doesn't have, you know, 4,500 admissions a year for trauma, then those occur very infrequently over time, and you don't really put it all together. Well, I submit to you that guy probably had a blunt carotid injury and had a big stroke and died. So in order to identify those patients before they have a stroke and die, then you have to be very aggressive in the screening. Now, if you just screen the people who have smashed faces, then again, you're going to miss 20% of the injuries. And to me, 20% is a little too high. I can live with 4%, but 20% is too high. So the easiest way to get everybody on the same page is just to be an aggressive screener. And if we're going to scan somebody's head, then at least to us, they've had enough trauma that warrants a CT scan of their head that they're going to get a CTA. Now, I'm not talking about the guy that just, you know, had a bottle broken over his head and needs a CTA. Needs a head CT. I'm not talking about that. But, I mean, somebody who's been in a car wreck or was cleaning their gutters out and fell off the roof or those sorts of things.
Dr. Grant, you identify an adrenal incidentaloma. You've done a functional workup. It's negative. And it grows a little bit. Do you repeat your functional workup?
No, well, you know, usually, theoretically, the answer would be no. Realistically, I guess we might. You know, having said that, there is an incidence of pre-cortisol, pre-Cushing's that evolves into noticeable Cushing's. And as I said, we've had a few people who've had a pheochromocytoma that it's sort of preclinical. That is, they don't have any symptoms of pheo, and when they were originally screened, they had normal metanephrines and catecholamines. I guess it would depend a little on the phenotype, but if they have much in the way of significant uptake on their dye injection, you know, we would screen them again for pheo, and we've actually, because of the level of confidence, if you see really a significant enhancement, we've actually blocked patients in case it's a pheo that have had negative catecholamines, and histologically it's turned out that way. So, you know, we might redo the test, but they're usually very good the first time. So, it's a little hard to know exactly how to answer that. It depends on maybe the time. If it's 3 months, maybe no. If it's more, then, you know, we very likely would.
Dr. McGrath, regarding the use of blue dye during pregnancy, does it matter, methylene blue, isosulfan blue, you just avoid it altogether?
I would avoid it altogether because I'm not aware of any sort of case reports in which it's been done. And, you know, there are some adverse reactions, rare, but I don't think people want to go there. And I'm not sure, since it's been shown that the radioactive sulfur colloid particles are safe, I'm not sure why you would necessarily need to switch and add blue dye. So
yeah, that's been our practice as well. Avoid the blue dye of any type, but strangely enough, radioactive colloid is okay. It's very, very safe.
Yeah. I mean, the amount of gamma radiation is, you get more flying than you do with a sentinel node.
Dr. Grant, what about the role of PET scans in adrenal masses, obviously in the setting of no other malignancy?
You know, and the other that was the reason that we got it, because we were trying to decide, does this patient have metastatic breast cancer to a single site, which we probably still would have said, rare as it is, we probably would go ahead. If we found stage 4 disease elsewhere, then we would have been hard-pressed to say we ought to go take a metastatic lesion out when we're leaving other disease behind. So in that setting, yeah, I think a PET scan is very valuable. We don't use PET scans almost ever outside that situation, though.
So in other words, you have a malignancy that can metastasize to the adrenal, could be 20 years ago. You're probably going to get a PET scan on that person.
Oh, yeah. You got to have it sort of within the reality. I mean, if it were a melanoma, a renal cell cancer, those can come back and haunt you whenever. And both of those, even if they spread to the adrenal, you know, we would, if we happen to know that even ahead of time, we'd still talk about resecting, because both of those you can win in those situations, and they can be very delayed metastatic disease to the adrenal. You know, you kind of have to fit the the test to the situation. But if they've got significant question of metastatic disease, then a PET scan would be a good choice.
Okay. Just a couple more questions. Dr. McGrath, any age cutoff for Gleevec, either before or after surgery?
Not that I'm aware of.
Pretty well tolerated.
Yes, very well tolerated, except for the wallet. It's expensive drug, and I think it's about 4 more years till it goes off PET.
All right. Dr. Grant, if you're reimplanting parathyroid into the arm, how much tissue do you generally reimplant?
Good question. What I do is mince up the parathyroid. Now, this is if it's abnormal parathyroid, I transplant to the arm because it's a whole lot easier if you ever have to go back, and eventually, at times, you will. You want it to be easily accessible in the arm rather than more difficult to get at in the neck. If you're implanting normal parathyroid, then you can mince it up. You can make one opening in the sternocleidomastoid. You can use a good stuffing maneuver, putting all the pieces in there. They tend to want to extrude, so you have to stuff for a little while. And then put maybe a stitch, a figure of eight stitch there. If it's in the arm, then the way I do those is I have the arms down when I'm doing the operation, so it's a second prep and drape. Extend the arm, put it in the brachioradialis, you make an incision, expose the brachioradialis, and then I put in probably a dozen individual pieces of parathyroid that are about 2 by 1 or 2 by 2 millimeters. And I implant it down into the muscle, and it's like sort of planting corn. I put a stitch of, I use proline, you can use something, but proline is least reactive rather than silk, for example, like a 5-0 proline. And what that does is it marks each site. And so you end up with 4 rows of 3 or 3, you know, something like that. Whether it's 10 or 12 or 15 is a bit arbitrary. You know that a portion of that is going to die. But if you're putting parathyroid in that's hyperfunctioning, you've got a very good chance, if you put it in immediately, and that is at the same operation, that it will function. Strangely enough, when we've followed up patients who we have done reoperative parathyroid surgery on, we think we're implanting parathyroid because they're out of parathyroid. This was before we used intra-PTH, and we implanted it. And then, lo and behold, the patient ended up cured of their hyperparathyroidism but did not end up hypopara. We actually have a pretty low frequency of overfunction. So it's actually a pretty decent fail-safe. It takes added time because it's tedious, you know, plan a little, put a stitch in, do it again. I mean, it's a great thing for a resident. You show them one and then have them do the other 11.
You have lunch, right?
But it's it does work. It can be completely sufficient for parathyroid function. It doesn't work immediately. The soonest I've ever seen is 2 weeks, and it can sometimes go 6 to 9 months before it functions, but it usually will.
All right. Well, last question before lunch. It's a provocative one. Breast cancer patient with a negative axillary exam, a completely negative ultrasound, is there a future for leaving that axilla alone completely?
I think it depends on the primary tumor. You have to look at the characteristics of the tumor. I think that down the road, it very well may get to that point. You know, Oncotype has already made huge changes in the way we manage some breast cancer, and, you know, it really gets down to the biology of the tumor. We're already, tubular carcinomas, for example, they're so well differentiated, very, very unlikely to go to nodes. We omit the axillary dissection of that. Here's where, though, you have to be on the same page with your medical oncologist. And so part of the benefit is we have a group working together, and we're able to sit ahead of time and say, this has such a low likelihood. Are you okay with us omitting? And they say yes. Otherwise, if you're in a practice and then that patient goes on and sees a medical oncologist and they're like, what the heck were they doing? They should have been doing a sentinel node. So you have to sort of work together. But there will be a time when we can reliably predict which nodes, you know, which cases are going to have node positivity or not.
There's actually a trial that I'm told is yet to actually come online, but was originating in Italy, where, and apropos to the preoperative evaluation, if the tumor is going to be dealt with by lumpectomy, and it fits within what is the what were the Z11 criteria, so size, et cetera, and if you get a preoperative ultrasound of the axilla, and it's either completely negative, or if there were anything suspicious, you put a needle in and you sample, and it's negative, then there is a trial to not do anything to the axilla in that situation. So as compared to, and not even do a sentinel node, because the likelihood of a sentinel node and more nodes being positive is really low given a negative ultrasound. You have to have good ultrasonography, et cetera. But yeah, I think the evolution of the axilla management is, as you've alluded to, it's in transition, and it will continue to transition more.
Great.
So all right. Stay tuned to Dr. Oz, because he'll
be on the Today Show.
And right. The Today Show, and yeah, Good Morning America.
All right, well, that concludes our morning session. Much thanks to our speakers. We're back here at 1:15. If you step outside the door, the lunch is down in the patio. Hopefully there's somebody out there telling you where to go. Thanks a lot.